Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and along with my co-founder, Will Campion, we created this show in 2020 to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment and business worlds. Episodes are available on audio via most podcast platforms and on video via our YouTube channel. And we're active on all major social media platforms. To stay up to date with every episode, please do sign up to our newsletter at moneymazepodcast.com. And we'd like to thank you for listening. If we could ask one favour, we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about us. Thank you. In 1932, the United States was in the grip of the Great Depression. One in four Americans didn't have work. Nearly 9,000 banks had failed. Franklin Roosevelt was elected for the first of his four terms as president of the US, and a retirement system for state employees was established in California. The retirement system grew into what is known as the California Public Employees Retirement System, aka CULPERS. Today, it's America's largest public pension fund, managing over $465 billion. I'm here in London on a dull November afternoon, and it's 8 a.m. in a sunny Sacramento, state capital of California, and I'd like to welcome its CEO, Marcy Frost. Welcome, Marcy.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you today.
I'd like to set the scene by just looking back, particularly at your early years, because you're in public service. You know, it's not everybody's choice. I wonder whether you came from a family where that was a conversation or whether it was really serendipity.
Yeah, so I think it was serendipity or opportunity or just wanting to be a bit different than the opportunity set that my family had throughout generations. So come from a really humble, poor family, and I really saw my family struggle financially, whether that was my own upbringing or I did spend a lot of time with my grandparents, and my grandparents worked very hard, and my grandfather in particular, and you know, they relied on Social Security and whatever they had personally saved. And he was a timber faller, very humble guy, very hardworking person. But I'm the first one really that has done something other than lower income types of opportunities or occupations. And, you know, I really wanted to change that for my own family. And so it brought me to, I grew up in Forks, Washington, which is a tiny little town on the Olympic Peninsula. And just that idea and that notion that I wanted something better. I wanted to break that cycle a bit for my own family. At that time, I had two very young daughters. And so I moved to Olympia, which is the capital of Washington State, and I took a typist job. And over the next 25 years, I moved through the organization. I actually changed once. And I left there in 2016 to come join CalPERS, but I left as the executive director of the Department of Retirement Systems. I was appointed by Governor Jay Inslee. I served on his cabinet, which was just a real thrill for me. And then I also was the chair of the Washington State Investment Board. I was an ex officio member based on my cabinet appointment. So there's a lot in there. I'm happy to unpack any of that, but it really is trying to change and make the opportunity set better for my own family than I think was afforded to me over time.
Clearly, you succeeded extremely well. And one of the debates we see, and I see it amongst friends' children now, is to go to university or not to go to university. And it was sort of a rite of passage for many, sort of a middle-class rite of passage, but you know, I'm talking here from a European perspective. And yet there are obvious demerits in that, cost being one, but also the abundance of marginal degrees. And I think that I'm going to speak, because I'm always upset somebody, but a deterioration in the overall standard of universities in the UK, where there's been a greater bifurcation between the really good and the less good. I mean, how do you think about weighing that up? You've got two daughters, you just said.
Yes, so I have two daughters. I also have a son, and they all have their formal degrees. My older daughter is a principal at a school in Oregon. And so I think for me, it wasn't that I was opposed to going to college. It was just trying to prioritize me over my family. And that was not a choice that I made. So I do not have a formal degree. My degree really came through, or my job training and development really came through all of these various occupations that I held. But I think more importantly, it's the people who I worked with and for. I had incredible leaders helping me, steering me. I had sponsors who, when I wasn't in the room, they were speaking on my behalf to open up that next job or that next assignment. So I have just this incredible network in Washington. Of course, I had to build that when I came to California. That was one of the challenges. I knew no one here when I came to California, and I left behind my entire professional network that I had built over 30 years. And so, you know, I'm not opposed to it by any means, but for me, it was finding the time. It was prioritizing it over raising a family. I was a very young mother. I had two young daughters by the time I was 19 years old. And then my son came when I was 25 years old. And as I said, they all are very successful, all have degrees from institutions and are doing quite, quite well. But I think it's really a personal choice. You know, there are individuals, youth, who can really thrive in that kind of setting or that kind of environment. I think there should be more equal emphasis and equal value placed on technical skills, you know, voc rehab types of skills. And I think we should be encouraging of that and not make it such a negative marker on your resume or a negative marker as if you don't have the drive or you're not intelligent enough to get your 4-year or 6-year degree. That's just not the case. I think that it's putting people in a box without really getting to know someone and what their capabilities are and what their aptitude is. That's something I'm very careful of in my career, just based on my own experience. I never box anyone in, try to figure out what they're really good at and make sure that we can align an assignment up with the skill set that they have. So really focusing on their strength areas, not really trying to demoralize people by saying, well, you don't have this or you don't have that, so you don't get these opportunities, you don't get these jobs. I don't look at it that way. I never have. But again, I think that's a lot based on my own personal experience. And I just don't want to be that type of leader. I want to be a leader where people can be coached, people can be mentored, people can be steered based on what I see or what the organization would see as their areas of strength.
Thank you. That's very clear. And I'm going to get to Culpers, but you said something that's really interesting, because I think, and that was about the network. You went to the West Coast, you have to build your network from scratch. And networks are one of those unsung key arteries that can determine more or less success. How did you build your network?
I worked really hard to be noticed. I just spent a lot of time reflecting back on those early days, but I started as a typist. So I worked really hard to type. I took typing classes in high school, and I aged myself a little bit there, and shorthand classes in high school. And because I didn't have that degree on my resume, I always felt I had to work harder than those around me. And I also would take on assignments or work on teams to solve problems really that no one wanted to get close to. And so it built a brand or a reputation. And I wanted my brand to be someone who is a problem solver, someone who can work with a team, someone who has that drive and that grit to get through the really difficult times. And that brand ended up being noticed by leaders in these organizations who would then come and tap me on the shoulder and say, we'd really like you to come work on this team, or we've got this problem we're trying to solve. So I think when you do a job well, you get noticed. I know there's a lot of conversation about, you know, well, the hustle culture, it's toxic. We don't want to see that in our organizations today. But I was really a part of that hustle culture. I worked hard and I was really dedicated to making sure that my brand stayed very clear. And I was really mindful about that early on. I don't know why, but when I have reflected back on that, I was really careful about my brand and my reputation. Every choice I made was, is this going to further this brand or this reputation that I want to convey? So that worked for me. And as a part of it, I was mentored. I took feedback well. I think that's another secret for people early in their careers. Take the feedback well when you get it. Those are gifts coming to you. If you don't take that feedback, it's really going to be likely problematic for your future growth. But listen to people, take the feedback and apply that feedback. Just really listen. So, you know, the way that you listen is you take the feedback and then you act differently or you perform differently into the future. And so I think I did that And then because I had some great leaders who did that for me, it created kind of this desire for me to be able to offer that back to the people who were working with me.
That's very clear. Culpers, where you have risen to this position of being their CEO. Can we just summarize for listeners who are less familiar around the world, size, mission, and primary stakeholders?
So CalPERS, as you indicated, it is the largest US-based public pension system. I try not to focus on, you know, we're the largest by any means. We are a retirement plan. We are a pension plan. We have 2.3 million members. About 800,000 of those are already retired. And then we have a number of new employees coming in as, you know, those retirees exit. We have a portfolio that's roughly worth $510 billion and makes us about 75% funded. So assets compared to liabilities, that's a number certainly that we want to have increase over time. And it has increased over time. We also are the second largest purchaser of healthcare in the United States. And a lot of people don't know that about CalPERS. So we're dual mission. We have the pension side, and then we also have this healthcare purchasing, and we cover about 1.6 million lives on our healthcare side. The stakeholders in California are very engaged, and I really do enjoy that. And the needs or the expectations are quite varied. So we have our active labor partners who are the people who really fought, I think, really early on to get a pension system in California. And this created that culture that labor and worker rights are extremely important. And a part of having rights and being a good employer is to make sure we have a pension system and a good healthcare system available to, in this case, public sector workers. We have 3,000 participating employers. So those are the employers who are paying contributions into the system on the behalf of their employees. And then our retiree groups are very active. They attend our board meetings. We have board meetings almost every month, and they're in the audience. It's a very busy stakeholder environment to the point that we have a stakeholder engagement team, both in our communications and public affairs side, and we're starting to build that out more on the investment side of the house, just because there are so many inquiries around, why are you invested in this? We think you should divest from X or Y. And really sitting down and explaining to those stakeholders why we don't think divestment is the right answer, at least not the right first answer.
Okay, and I'm definitely coming back to that because that's important. But I just want to stay with the liability because Western pension funds are being squeezed by the same pressure. I had a look at the report and accounts. If I've understood it correctly, I think you just hinted at that, you know, circa $500 billion in assets, $650 billion in liabilities. So you've got a unfunded actuarial, you know, liability, whatever it is, $180 billion or so. How do you think about that in terms of timelines and closing it?
Back in 2013, Governor Brown was in office at the time, and there was a new pension benefit tier open called PEPRA. And so PEPRA applies to all new employees hired January 1 of 2013 or after. I happen to be a PEPRA member. And that benefit design, that structure is far less value than the classic structure that has been in place since the 1930s. And so that is one of my primary focus areas is 75% funded, you know, no one wants to see gray, right? 75% funded is not where we need to be, but we do have an actuarial funding plan that pays down the unfunded liability over time. I think that's about a 15-year horizon right now, as long as our actuarial assumptions play out to be true, whether those are the economic assumptions around inflation, whether those are demographic assumptions around mortality, all of that factors in. And we look at this every 4 years. We're right in the midst of starting our new asset liability management review. So on the asset side, this is where our board of trustees will look at the portfolio, how the portfolio is invested, and look at the risk appetite related to our current portfolio, which has a 6.8% return assumption over 30 years. And then we'll look at the liabilities over the last 4 years via the experience study. Has anything changed significantly enough that we need to modify our inflation assumption, our salary growth assumption, our mortality assumption? On the mortality side, that's where we've really been hurt in the past around we haven't anticipated or forecasted mortality well enough, but we are now large enough as a system having a group of retirees that we can have our own actuarial mortality tables. And that's been really helpful to us. So we're in the process of that. that will conclude November of 2025, where the board will make final choices around the candidate portfolio for the next 4 years and factor in these actuarial assumptions in doing so. So it's a good time to weigh in at CalPERS. You know, the stakeholders are weighing in now on what they like about the current portfolio, what they do not like about the current portfolio. It's a very active environment. And like I said, I really enjoy it. I enjoy hearing from the membership.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. The Money Maze podcast is proudly sponsored by the London Stock Exchange Group, a global leader in financial markets infrastructure. LSEG has a rich history of facilitating capital flows, empowering businesses, and connecting investors to opportunities. Today, they provide world-class technology, data, and analytics, playing a critical role in shaping modern finance. From their role in sustainable investing to their contributions to financial innovation, LSEG is helping to build a more connected and efficient market. Visit LSEG.com via the link in the show notes to see how they're driving the future of finance. In times of economic and geopolitical volatility, investors will look to gold. Today, as the world navigates uncertainty and heightened risk, investors of all sorts will look to safeguard their wealth. We're thrilled to welcome the World Gold Council as one of our sponsors. Tap the link in the show notes to learn more or visit goldhub.org on your browser for comprehensive research, insights, and analysis on the global gold market. So let's talk about strategic versus tactical allocation. And I'm sure that at the strategic level, there are guardrails that are set up because you have these liabilities. And yet, having been in this business and run tactical asset allocation early in my career, I'm always intrigued about how much room for maneuver you have. So just help us understand that, because it can make a big difference in the end to performance, good or bad.
Yeah, sure can. I would say that CalPERS in our history has been very much in that strategic asset allocation versus tactical, although we do have some room to maneuver on our policy allocation. So for example, if we are 8% allocated to private equity, as a part of that 8% allocation, which also addresses any market fluctuations, we have a +5 or a -5 that we can maneuver within. So we can go to a 13% or we can go down to a 3% if we feel that's necessary, or we have issues around markets or denominator effect or whatever that might be. So there is some flexibility that's been granted by the trustees for the investment office to use their judgment in certain market conditions that are going to happen in a four-year period of time. But I think that's what, you know, we have a new chief investment officer, newer, you know, he's entered his fourth month here at CalPERS. And these are questions that we've started to invite the board to discuss with us around whether it is pure strategic asset allocation or is it more reference portfolio? Because on strategic asset allocation, you have to be careful that you don't have silos within the asset classes formed, that these are my checks to write, not your checks to write, and that cross-collaboration isn't as effective. So we're always cautious about that. You want to write the check where we believe we're going to get the value and the return. And the cautionary tale, I guess, is if you have an 8% allocation of private equity, but you're not seeing the deal flow, yet private credit is at a 3% allocation and you think it should be 5%. We do have some flexibility to do that today, but we want to have more of those risk appetite discussions with the board and really get our team to the point that it is full collaboration across sustainable investments, which comes in. They don't have their own allocation in the portfolio, so they are sitting alongside all of the heads of the allocations, whether that's private equity, private credit, real assets, which includes real estate and infrastructure. And really building that team that is looking and searching for the right deals to bring into CalPERS. And I think Stephen is really going to be the right person to lead that kind of change at CalPERS. It is a change, but I think that's where we're headed over the next 4 to 8 years.
So I'm going to just pause on that because, of course, having the theoretical ability is different from being able to actually pull the trigger. So when you get a, if it's not a dislocation, it's you use the PE, the private equity, private debt sort of, you know, parallel. Just talk me through what happens to trigger the allocation switch.
Again, we have some flexibility. Typically, it's happening in our governance. You know, we have a number of governance meetings that are in the investment office that are led by They could be led by the CIO. They could be led by the head of the asset class. And you have different risk appetites, whether you're in private credit, which tends to be a little less risky. You got private equity. They're a little more comfortable with risk. And it's inviting those conversations and that cross. It's not just training. It's really a mindset about we're going to follow the best deal that even though I have that 8% allocation, this is just not my checkbook, for lack of a better term. It's not my checkbook to get to 8% if I don't believe 8% is going to get the value that a private credit check would get. And so right now, for example, we are recruiting for the head of our private credit team. And as a part of this cross collaboration, we put our head of private equity over both private credit and private equity. And I think what we're seeing play out pretty clearly is these risk conversations, right? So private credit will underwrite and do their due diligence in a certain way. Private equity does it also in a certain way, but so much to learn amongst the teams. And that's been a real positive, I think, as the new private credit head will be coming in, I would assume, over the next 30 to 60 days.
And am I reading between the lines here, but do I get the impression that you're trying to institute a little more entrepreneurialism and flexibility into the equation?
Yes, I think that's a great way to put it. We're an organization that, you know, has been around for a very long time. And even though there are discussions about the turnover at CalPERS, the turnover really only has been at the chief investment officer level. Most of our heads of the asset classes have been with us for quite a long time. So if they're in, you know, that job as a new head of the asset class, they likely grew up in the asset class or another asset class at CalPERS. You know, the head of our real assets team started as an intern here. Dan Bienvenu has been here almost 20 years. Arnie Phillips, who's over fixed income, he's been here over 30 years. So you just have to be careful that we're testing ourselves, we're challenging ourselves. If these systems of how we work together get built in over time, we need to make sure that we're challenging one another still to make sure that that 6.8% return or greater is achievable, that our employers are really relying on us to do as best as we can. Anything that we get over the 6.8 is a positive to paying down that unfunded actuarial liability, which is really the pain point at CalPERS for our public employers. And I think they would like to see us be even more driven around that's our purpose is in order to protect retirement security and protect defined benefit plans, we need to make CalPERS as healthy as we can. And the primary health indicator, at least that we seem to be assessed on, which I think is a fair assessment, is the funding levels, that comparison between the assets and the liabilities. And if you talk to our membership group, that is the thing that they talk with us about. If they're concerned that their benefit may not be there for their lifetime, it does cause them some anxiety. You know, they're dedicating their service to the public. Many of these people have had opportunities likely to go to the private sector. But part of that is this deferred compensation model of a defined benefit plan that allows them to have the lifetime income. And I think there's just more that we can do there. And I think our new chief investment officer, when he interviewed, he expressed very clearly that that's the role that he sees taking on as heading up the team, heading up the portfolio. You know, it is a challenging position, challenging partly also because it is so public in nature and we're very transparent about what we do and how we invest.
So you've had probably, it would be fair to say, a reasonable amount of turnover at the CIO level. And is that, would you say, because you're trying again to force through a step change in approach?
Frankly, I think the turnover, and I'll give you the number. I've been here, I'm just entering my ninth year at CalPERS. I started in October of 2016. And Stephen Gilmore is my fourth CIO in that time frame. You compare that to a CalSTRS CIO, or you compare that to the Washington State Investment Board CIO, Gary Brubaker, who I worked with, who had been in their careers, you know, 20 some years or in their positions 20 some years. That's something we should expect. But what is different between a CalSTRS CIO or a Washington State Investment CIO is really the public nature of this position. And I think, you know, as we're doing these interviews, we do our best to really test someone's ability to be resilient when they're being questioned, when they're being critiqued, or when they're being attacked, frankly. And we did a lot more of that with Stephen. I find, you know, that, you know, problems with him being resilient through any kinds of questioning or critiquing that might come his way. But I think it's more the public nature of it. It gets very personal at times. And some individuals can really put that into a compartment, set it aside, understand that it really does not add any value and it really is intended to get in your way. And if you let it get in your way, then they win. So you can't let them win. But you have to have a little bit of that competitive spirit, a little bit of that persistence and grit to get through those times, because the job is so rewarding. What we stand for and what we do in these careers here at CalPERS is so important to, again, 2.3 million people who are relying on us to do our very best. But I think it's less about strategy, much more about being in this public eye. You know, we're written about almost every day. And most of what is written has become more factual, which I really appreciate. I see that as a positive trend. But, you know, for some reason, there are people still who don't want this defined benefit plan to be successful. And I think our charge and our challenge is to just set that aside and continue to make progress and show them what a fully funded system, a healthy system looks like.
So let's talk about the portfolio. One of the big debates is active versus passive. Warren Buffett reminds us of the fees that can be wasted in an overly expensive active managers. I want to talk both about equity, but also about fixed income, because there's a growing portion of assets now put in passive fixed income. Tell me about each of those, where, when, and how.
Well, I think it's manager selection, and it's also the underwriting of the deal. CalPERS, for its size and its relationships, we are able to craft, you know, fee structures that when the manager does well, which means we do well, then they're going to be paid appropriately, but not overly so. This is a public pension plan, and any dollar that's not in that trust fund being paid to members is something that we have to be accountable to and toward. And so I would say that, you know, about 5 years ago, we took a lot of the equity risk, active risk out of public equity. We didn't have much in fixed income. Most of our active risk really was in private equity and some in public equity. We stepped back from that. We defunded a lot of the active managers that we had at that time with the intention of, let's look at the processes, because as you indicate, those fees are really important. That extra layer of fees, when you compare that to a passive portfolio, it's very difficult to outperform the markets when you add on that extra layer of fees. And that is what we found about 5 years ago. So we took that step back and said, we need to reevaluate whether active has a place in fixed income, whether active has a place in global equity. And what we said is it has a place under certain conditions. And so manager selection, very, very important. So we really worked on our manager selection processes. And then fees matter. And so we have to have managers who understand that this is a public pension plan and we have to be really careful about that fee structure. We don't talk about fees, but it is something that is certainly top of mind as we're going into these type of strategy changes. And in fixed income, we have started to do a little bit more in active, again, where we have conviction in a manager. We hadn't done much of that, but I think under Arnie Phillips, under Nicole Musico, when she was here as the CIO, we really opened up that lens to look at active strategies again. And so we'll see. Those are just being planted and we'll see how they return over time. But we'll monitor that very closely just based on the experiences that we've had in the past. We know what we're looking for. We can see trend lines pretty quickly at this point. So I think the team is excited about it. I think the other thing that happens in Sacramento, it's oftentimes difficult to get the talent that you need to want to move to Sacramento, California. Now, I will tell you, it is lovely here. It is sunny. It's going to be warm today, but it's not really seen by a lot of investment types or finance types as being, you know, a financial hub. But it is lovely here, but it's not for everyone. And we have a policy that you have to be in the office, physically in the office 3 days a week. And we offer that 2 days of remote time, but not everyone wants to do that. And in particular, post-COVID, we found that a bit more tricky. And so in order to get the type of strategies that you need in place to get the returns we need, we've had to look at outsourcing or doing that active management a bit more.
Yeah, and much of the evidence has pointed to the fact that it is easier to outperform fixed income indices than equities, which makes sense intuitively. And in fact, down the road, it's probably 500 miles down the road, of course, is PIMCO. We had Manny Roman, the CEO of PIMCO, on earlier in the year. Really fascinating conversation. And I did touch base with him, and he had a question for you, which was, Getting on to my local versus global, he said after decades of American exceptionalism in stock market returns and US valuations high, what challenges does it cause to forward returns for public funds?
Our portfolio has always been a bit more tilted globally than many of our counterparts here in the United States. And that likely is some of the critique that we've received. We've had more exposure to those global markets, including 4 years ago when we brought in an emerging market sovereign debt strategy. And the countries in that particular index can be, you know, tricky on the geopolitical side, which does get our stakeholders pretty actively engaged if there, you know, are incidents that are happening in some of those countries. And so I think we will still look at emerging markets, we'll still look at global markets. Some of our sustainable investing opportunities are definitely, you know, we just announced one in the UK, are definitely global, but they're also domestically because there is so much need for infrastructure. So we do see opportunities in the United States around infrastructure. We need more allocators to really work on these private partnerships to get some of those major projects initiated. But global markets are going to be extremely important too for diversification in particular. And that's certainly something that we will pay close attention to. We do get a lot of questions about why we aren't more tilted US, but I would tell you that it's more around diversification. You know, that tilt has always been about diversification. But again, if we look across the river at our counterpart, they're not as tilted globally as we have been. And so trying to explain return differences to our stakeholders, that's been a bit of a challenge for me as well. But I think global markets is extremely important, but I want to see more opportunities, particularly in energy and infrastructure here in the United States.
So before we continue this conversation, we're going to take a short break to have a note from our sponsors. Schroders is a $950 billion public-private global asset management business. Built to deliver long-term client value, Schroders focuses their business on growing into areas where there is greater demand, private markets, bespoke solutions, and wealth management, and where they can better serve clients. Schroders take a long-term perspective and a leadership position in sustainability. With a 220-year history of successful adaptation and innovation, Schroders have always focused on serving clients. Remember, capital is at risk when investing. The Money Maze podcast is sponsored by IFM Investors, a global institutional asset manager whose purpose is to invest, protect, and grow the long-term retirement savings of working people. Owned by pension funds and inspired by their members, they invest in what matters. As a responsible investor, IFM actively engages with their portfolio companies on issues they care about, with the aim of improving net performance whilst minimizing risk. They manage investments across infrastructure, debt, listed equities, and private equity assets. To learn more, tap the link in the episode description below. So it's very interesting. So later this week, I'm interviewing Luba Nicolina from IFM. They're one of the largest infrastructure investors in the world. Really interesting asset class that's getting more attention. You know Mark Delaney from the Australian Super. In fact, I got a question from him later on. He described infrastructure as the ballast in the boat, which I thought was a very interesting term. How do you think about it and what weight, because I haven't seen that in your papers, what weight does it have today and where might it be?
It's going to have more weight in the portfolio. Those deals have been pretty limited. You know, trying to find deals of a certain size, $510 billion, you know, the checks and the funds that we would be involved in, we do this through a fund less directly, unless it was a co-investment. We really like co-investments when we have a, you know, conviction in a manager. But I think infrastructure, the US needs it so terribly badly, whether that's through the Inflation Reduction Act, and, you know, we'll see what happens next year around that. But infrastructure is a far better opportunity for investment outside of the US. And that just should not be the case. And what we would like to do is see our infrastructure allocation increase. We want to think about how the portfolio focuses on infrastructure and the team that we have currently working there. We have an incredible infrastructure team, but it's pretty small, a small, mighty team. But we really want to build that out. I think you'll hear some of the largest asset managers in the world talking about infrastructure as an opportunity set here in the US. But I think that is a fair assessment, a global need for infrastructure, whether that is for energy, whether that is, you know, on our side, it's for airports, it's for roads, it's for so many things that have been in decline for decades that we've not been reinvesting in. And I think CalPERS would love to be a part of that.
Yep, the US is not alone in that particular equation. So just before we leave the private markets, you've talked about private equity, private debt. You haven't talked about venture capital. You sit on the West Coast, you know, you've got access to great thinkers, minds, operators. How do you think about particularly private equity versus public equity? Because there is, you know, it's had a very robust sort of series of decades, particularly since Dave Swensen at Yale encompassed it, et cetera. But going forward, how do you weigh up those two components of the equity bucket?
We really took a deep look at private equity and the implementation style that we had for that asset class. We had a 15-year look back not too long ago about the pacing model for private equity. As an example, 809, we stopped funding. And, you know, the vintage years thereafter were pretty good. And we really, frankly, missed out. So that consistency element is very important. And that's something that we've embedded into the organization, that any investment we have will potentially have a few bumps along the way. But that is not a reason to exit, that consistency is the most important thing we can do once we determine the pacing model. But we do have a return expectation of 150 bips above public markets. And as you know, last year, most of the funds, if that is their benchmark, did not hit that, just simply based on the nature of the public markets last year. And so we still have a lot of conviction with private equity. We just increased the allocation there. And part of that is moving out of these mega buyout funds and really moving into more of that mid-market space. We hired a newer head of private equity who had been at CalPERS before. He was a return to CalPERS, which is always great to see. And he started bringing in some of the successes that he had another organization in terms of relationships. Private equity is a lot about relationships. You want to be that first call from a GP when there's a deal that they're really excited about. And I think we've really moved ourselves up on that call list over the last 5 years in particular. That was not always the case. I think when I came in 2016, the relationships with some of our general partners were really troubled. And just spending time understanding why and how has that happened over time. We also, because fees matter greatly, the implementation style has really moved under this new allocation into more co-investments. That's probably as direct as we're going to get, at least for the foreseeable future. I know we've had a lot of conversation with past CIOs about, can CalPERS do this more in a direct way, similar to the Canadian plans? I think co-investment over the near term and maybe the long term will be as direct as we get. But co-investments really help with that fee drag, which then can help drive better performance over time. So we are still big on private equity. We implemented our labor principles last year, and the labor principles apply to our private equity GPs. They apply to the public companies where we're investing. And essentially, all they say is, I'm going to follow all of the laws that relate to worker safety, creating an environment free of harassment, having employees have freedom of association. And what we saw is that I think we're at 80% of our GPs have now signed those labor principles. And so we have a board here, we have a very active stakeholder group that focuses a lot on worker rights and human capital. And these labor principles were really the byproduct of some work around how do we make sure that we have this alignment of interest between private equity, at least at that time, that's where the big discussion was happening, between private equity and CalPERS. And these labor principles emerged pretty quickly thereafter. And I think we're quite proud of those. And any conversations that we've had with the managers to date have just been around, we just need to make sure that anything that we sign on to falls within the fiduciary duty, not only of CalPERS, but of also of these general partners. And so that's been great to get in place. We now have a mechanism if there is an issue with a worker issue, whether that's freedom of association, whether that is we have public commenters coming to talk with us about harassment issues or safety conditions with a company that we're invested in, then we have this mechanism where we can engage directly with a portfolio company at times, if not the GP, but can also engage directly with that public company, whatever that company might be. It might be Tesla today, Exxon, Boeing, whatever that might be.
Right. So you touching on something, as I went through your materials, it was clear that this sustainable investment strategy was high priority. Now, if we get into the tent that is sustainability, but also incorporates good behavior, Larry Fink was on the front foot 2 years ago about a lot of stuff from which he has retracted or appears to have been somewhat, as we've met resistance in all sorts of quarters from the fact that the priority is investment returns and there's a balancing, whether it's the energy transition or, you know, a pragmatism seem to be being lost. How do you balance those forces of trying to optimize performance and also satisfy your constituents, or is it actually unreconcilable?
I think it's reconcilable. I do. Our fiduciary duty is for the exclusive benefit of our 2.3 million members. Every decision we make has to improve the likelihood that that benefit is going to be paid over long periods of time. And I know there's been a lot of tossing of the terms of ESG and DE&I, but I will tell you, CalPERS has been in the space for a very long time. And we've always looked at ESG. We'll just talk about ESG and climate, you know, for now. But we've always looked at that as a risk to CalPERS because we are investing over decades. We're not investing for a quarter. We're not investing to get the best returns that we can on an annual basis. We are investing over decades, 30-year time horizons. And climate is causing changes today that need to be recognized in the valuation of the companies, whether that's real estate or companies that are currently headquartered in certain areas. We have done some what we call zip code risk analysis, but all of this is steeped on data. I think that's the answer, is that any decision that we make follows a very sound process that is very steeped in the data. And we have a great team here at CalPERS who does the research, does the data analytics that all feeds into whatever investment decision that's being made. So when we do get criticized or we get asked to come to a hearing to explain what we're doing around ESG, we take that as an invitation to educate, to explain what's really happening, that just throwing out these terms as a way to argue back and forth, that's not something I'm real keen on. It's something maybe I have to do from time to time. But this is really fiduciary analysis and making decisions that will stand the test of time for our members.
So I think you said, I just want to come back to it, that your policy is not one of actively divesting initially. And I just particularly, let's talk about the energy space, because it's where a lot of attention has been focused. How would you describe your operating principles there?
So divestment is never the first option. And we've been pretty clear with our stakeholders. Again, these are opportunities to educate people who are very well-intentioned, but don't necessarily understand the responsibilities we have at CalPERS about paying those benefits and understanding this through a risk and return lens. And so we have been in on energy, and we also have, through our sustainable investing plan, I think there was a bit of a surprise to our stakeholders when we told them that we are going to invest in companies that are making the transition. So, you know, emissions are going to go up in the portfolio. So as we give them capital to move from kind of a brown operation to a dirtier operation to a greener operation, that's part of our sustainable investing plan as well. But we also implemented recently a climate transition index that we really believe that there are opportunities in the energy transition, and we believe that companies need to manage that risk over time. And so what this climate transition index will do is reward the companies that we think are managing that risk appropriately, right? That have a commitment, have a plan, are managing emissions, particularly scope one and scope two. We can speak about scope three if you want. I know there's a lot of debate around that, but for me, the data that's important to me, and you know, the investors on the other side of the house may agree or not, that really is around scope one and scope two. So if we see that there is, you know, a CapEx level that companies are spending for energy transition, we want to be a part of that company. We want that company to be using our capital to do that. If we believe that there are companies that just have said, we're not doing this, then over time, that company will be underweighted in the portfolio versus the counterparts that we think are using an appropriate CapEx and are really focused on transitional operations.
So that's very pragmatic. So the two assets that we didn't touch on, and they're both very different, but they elicit different responses from CIOs and CEOs in organizations like yours. One is hedge funds, two is commercial real estate. Could you maybe just touch on your thinking on each?
Yeah, so commercial real estate was certainly an underperformer for everyone. Our portfolio has been pretty high grade, and so it underperformed less than many of our counterparts. But that is something that we're going to have to keep an eye on, whether people will return to the office. You're seeing many more companies 3-4 years later requiring employees to come back. We've actually been in the office over 2 years on our 3-day, 2-day. So, you know, we're going to watch that as a trend. But we have Class A office space, but the Bay Area is kind of a tale of two cities. What's going on in the Bay Area is very different than what's going on in New York, where we also have holdings. So we're going to wait and see, you know, a period of time, that the valuations of those are not really in a place that we'd want to sell off at this point. So, and then on hedge funds, that's a diversifying type of strategy. And as a part of our ALM, hedge funds will be looked at again. We did exit from those under a former CIO, mainly based on scale, right? We owned a lot too much of the market at that time, as well as the fee structure. But they are great for diversification. And diversification is the only thing that you really get, you know, for free, not free on fees, but diversification is the way that you can really balance out not having to predict the future, which none of us can. So it will be back on the table for us to look at. Everything really is on the table when you're doing asset liability management review. But again, I think the team would say these are diversifying strategies and we should take a look at them.
Great. And when we bring this all together, you're sitting at the head of this organization. I'm not underestimating how difficult it is. Let's think about culture for a minute and leadership. What are the one or two things that you most want to encourage amongst your fellow workers?
I thought about a lot about leadership. And I think for individuals who work their way through an organization, you have experiences with wonderful leaders, and then you have experiences with leaders who were not so wonderful. And both can shape you in ways, shape you in a way, well, I want to do more of that, or I want to do less of that. So for CalPERS, culture is really important. We want to be known as a destination employer. We're a public entity. I spend a lot of time with our new employees and I ask them, what is it about CalPERS that you heard that made you want to apply for a job here? And a lot of them, it's about the development, the way that we invest in our team. It's about the fact that we have a leadership model that our leaders treat employees really well, meaning leaders see their job as serving their teams, not vice versa. The teams don't serve the leader. So these cultural norms of strong leadership behaviors that are supportive of our team, whether our team wants to promote, whether our team wants to develop, having a high retention rate, that's something I watch for, retention and turnover. But I just want people to feel that they can be their best self at CalPERS, that we embrace a culture where people can innovate, that their ideas matter, their ideas will be implemented, that we embrace a culture where people can fail forward, that failure isn't a career stopper. Failure is, you know, taking some risk, but if that failure, we don't want to see repeated, you know, same failures, but taking on risk is important here. So having an environment that supports that innovation, creativity, and if you're really innovative, you're going to have some failures along the way. Let's embrace it. Let's figure out how to move forward after a failure. What did we learn from it? How do we apply that learning to the next step in this process? And so that's really what I want. I want people to refer their friends and their family members to work at CalPERS. That net promoter score, that's something I track as well. We do an annual employee engagement survey that just closed out, something I pay very close attention to. And our leaders do as well. They take one item out of that engagement survey every year. And we're the only ones who do this in this Perceptics. We use Perceptics to do this, that every leader takes an action, makes an action plan with their team about how to improve one area that the team wants to focus on. And we've seen improvements over time.
And size can so often be the enemy of agility. And is there something that sits at the top of your list when you think, big organization, how do I energize and how do I reinforce the need to be agile? What would that be?
It's really teaching our leaders how to invite those conversations with the team. It's also, we have a senior leadership council. Typically, where organizations are not as agile as they need to be, it's really, they call it the frozen middle layer. And so we spend a lot of time with our senior leadership council, empowering them, engaging with them so that they can really keep the organization agile, that we can solve problems quickly, that we're not doing processes and work the same way because we've always done it that way for the last 10 years. I also invite all of our new employees to find one process that they think needs to be improved upon. And then we have a leadership group who is open to those conversations about, okay, that's a great idea. This is a new set of eyes on this particular issue. Let's invite that innovation, that creativity. We have an emerging leader program where each of these emerging leaders are paired up with a current leader, including my executive team, and they are assigned a problem to solve that then gets reported out. So we're really inviting that innovation, that problem solving and creativity is just a part of the DNA at CalPERS. And we want to see those problems solved when they're a band-aid to solve it versus when we're in an operating room trying to solve it. And that's really taking our employees who are working closest to these processes, closest to our members, and making it safe for them to say, this is not working and we need to change this, fix this, improve this.
So I mentioned earlier, but we had a few weeks ago, Mark Delaney, who's the CEO of AustralianSuper, Australia's largest pension fund. He said, he did say, Marcy's a great operator, so he's clearly a fan of yours. And his question was, how do you encourage CalPERS to navigate such a highly scrutinized environment?
It can be challenging. And I think as employees decide to move up in this organization, it is a factor you have to think about differently at CalPERS than you would really anywhere else, particularly as a public entity. So for me, I've learned, and I try to teach this to my team and so on for their teams, is that, does this really matter? Is this an issue that matters? And if it doesn't matter, and sometimes it's considering the source of the information, you have to set it aside. You have to compartmentalize that in a way that it doesn't stop your progress. The moment it stops your progress, what they intended to do has now happened. Now, that takes a lot of discipline. It takes a lot of confidence. And it takes a lot of people working with one another to make sure we are seeing around all of the corners. But that's the skill set that you have to have, and that mentality and that attitude in order to sit in these higher level positions at CalPERS. And again, I think if you are embracing failure in a way that people can learn from it, they will take a little bit more risk. But I will tell you, there is a bit of a risk aversion simply based on the fact that we are so public. And I feel fortunate that people are willing to talk about that, talk through that with us, and we can figure out our plan around it. But also, you know, I have a very talented communications team, public affairs team. I hired someone who worked at the LA Times as a bureau chief here in Sacramento. He's been very helpful in explaining to our teams, really, what is the intention behind this story? So sometimes we might react to it more personally than we need to. But having someone who really comes from that side, and it's not, you know, the media that's doing this, but just anyone who says, oh, you know, I'm going to criticize CalPERS for this, really sitting down and figuring out, well, what is the why? Like, what? Why is this really happening? And once we have that discovery, it's less personal and we can just move forward. There's an incident that happened in CalPERS over a decade ago that, you know, once you lose a brand for a period of time, it's very difficult to get it back. And, you know, I'm seeing wonderful progress there and we're going to continue making that progress.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting strategy of lowering the temperature by having somebody who's been on the other side of the journalistic profession. I have three closing questions. One comes from a great friend. Her name is Patricia Chadwick. She was one of the most successful portfolio managers on Wall Street, 1970s and 80s. She's just written a new book called The Witch of Wall Street. And her question was, what advice would you give to young women starting out in finance?
I found myself coaching on this more recently. We started an event post-COVID called Pathways for Women. And the reason I did that, and we now have done this as a part of the offerings at CalPERS, is far too often in those meetings, those Zoom rooms, I was the only female in the room. And so I love the book, The Witch of Wall Street. I haven't read that yet. I'm going to need to do that.
I'll get her to sign one and send you a copy.
Great. And so It's finding your voice. I've been coaching on that a lot lately. I think women earlier in their career find it a little more difficult to find their voices around what they're passionate about, what they stand for, what their personal brand is, and really sticking to that personal brand as much as you possibly can. The brand of what am I really good at and how do I know what I'm good at, but also finding some sponsors. Women cannot promote as equally, and still in this day cannot promote as equally without male sponsors helping them, speaking about them. So make sure you're developing a network of male sponsors and female sponsors. And then just working with women. Sometimes women, we tend to be much harder on our female counterparts than we are our male counterparts. And so just if you're in that place to help lift women, please do so and invite those conversations around risk-taking. There's no reward if you don't take some risk, taking that feedback, but it's really finding your voice. I got some coaching from someone who I have a lot of respect for, and I didn't have my voice early in my career. Just, you know, it was more of this heads down, working hard, finding that way to be noticed versus finding my voice and what I stood for. And I made that change mid-career, and it just opened so many doors that I would not have seen even available to me. And so that would be the advice. I think find your voice and make sure you pay attention to building out that network and knowing what you're good at and spend more time doing that and less time about the things that you're not as interested in doing.
That's great advice. We support something called GAIN here in the UK, Girls Are Investors, and it's been a great force for encouraging young women to join the investment industry. And I think what you just said really resonates. So thank you. Two final questions. There are a lot of great investors around the world. Who's the one that you'd like to go and have dinner with?
Wow. Mark Delaney. How about that? I have a lot of respect for Mark. I sit with him on a board. I know there are great investors outside of the private sector, and I get a lot of interaction with them. But Mark has a great sense of humor. He's done a great job in his career. And I just have not had a chance to sit down and talk with him about his own pathway and how he's done it and what excites him about, you know, getting up and running the portfolio. But yeah, I'd go to dinner with Mark.
Okay, great. And the unclimbed peak, metaphorically, what would you like to think? And I'm not going to say 5 years. I'm going to say, because you're pretty young, is that, you know, within 20 years, what else might you like to have done?
Within this space or just generally?
I want general, It can be as left field as you like.
I have this creative side to me as well, that creativity and problem solving, you know, in an office environment or a finance environment is a bit different than creativity. And so I love to design. You know, if I wouldn't have done this or my path wouldn't have led me here, I likely would have done something more in architecture and design, although my team always tells me you should have been an attorney because I like to argue. But I would have done something more in architecture and design. I really enjoy that. And it's when I need a bit of an outlet or a step away, that's typically where I'm more motivated to go. And my younger daughter is a co-owner of a design firm that does very large commercial real estate design, multifamily housing all over the United States, and they're based in Portland, Oregon. And so she's got a little bit of the dream job for me too.
Great. Well, look, Marcy, we're going to end it here. I've been looking forward to this conversation. You have a very public position. It's a very important organization. I'm stating the obvious there, but it is extremely, you know, important. Two things I'm taking from this. One is that you're prepared to look internationally. That's been a little bit in your culture, but, you know, particularly with US valuations, that's something that you're not afraid of. Secondly, that infrastructure in the US as well as overseas is something that you're likely to allocate more to, and there where there is a, you know, a great need. And I think finally, and we'll reiterate this in, you know, in the show notes, your advice for young women in finance is really valuable. So I hope we get to meet as well, you know,
yes,
at some point. And we really appreciate you being here with us today. Thank you very much, Marcy.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I enjoyed it. And I would love to sit down and have dinner with you as well.
Well, very kind. Well, we will see if we can fix that. So, Marcy, that's great. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making or refraining from making any specific investment or other decisions. We try to provide content that is true and accurate as of the date of publishing, However, we give no assurance or warranty regarding the accuracy, timeliness, or applicability of any of the content. Guests, presenters, and other individuals involved in the production of this podcast may have positions in any of the investments discussed.